Welcome to Ancient Afterlives. I'm Joe Scales, a Bible scholar, historian of ancient Judaism, and podcasting extraordinaire. Today I'm joined by two archaeologists whose primary research for many years has been on the ancient synagogue. So we're going to have a roundtable discussion, thinking about all things related to the synagogue. You may have noticed that Ancient Afterlives has been on somewhat of a hiatus. Our release schedule is very patchy at the moment, so you can expect some intermittent releases as things are recorded and put out. But I've been working with a colleague on a new podcast project, which is going to be slightly different, a lot less rambly and a lot more focused. So watch this space for announcements coming towards the end of 2022. Anyway, enough about that and my other projects. I'll introduce our guests. Dr. Tina Rosala is an archaeologist, researcher, writer, video gamer, and biblical scholar. Her work concentrates on the intersection of religious material culture and the archaeology of the ancient Near East, with a focus on ancient Judaism and early Christianity. She received her PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the autumn of 2021, and her thesis examined coin deposits found in synagogues in late antique Palestine. This dissertation can be found entirely online at www.ancientsynagoguecoins.com. Tina has spent time working for several academic and non-profit organizations, including the Kinneret Regional Project, ASOR Early Career Scholars Committee, the Carolina Center for Jewish Studies, and the Save Ancient Studies Alliance. She's recently started a new position as the curator for the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience in New Orleans. And our second guest is Dr. Rick Bonney, who received his PhD in archaeology in 2014 from the University of Leuven. He is currently a university lecturer in museology in the Department of Cultures at the University of Helsinki and a founding member of the Centre of Excellence in Ancient Near Eastern Empires. His research interests include museum and heritage ethics, object biographies, decolonization and provenance issues, museum collection histories, and sensory archaeology. He is currently working on two projects. The first, entitled Making Home Abroad, Understanding Migrant Experiences and Heritage Implementation in Finland, is funded by the Finnish Cultural Foundation. And the second, titled Religious Responses to Climate Change in the Southern Levant, funded by a University of Helsinki three-year project. Welcome, Rick and Tina. We'll kind of kick off generally, and I'm interested in how each of you kind of first became interested in synagogues, and you're both archaeologists, so I presume this is kind of through the study of archaeology. But why don't we start with Tina? So when did you first kind of discover synagogues and what they are and your interest in it?
Well, I think me and Rick might have come to that point at the same time in life, because we met actually on an excavation site where we were excavating an ancient synagogue. So a long time ago, I was studying in the Netherlands and I was taking a class with a professor called Jürgen Zangenberg. And Jürgen said that he was starting an excavation project in Israel, in the Galilee all the way up north in Israel. And it was going to be a site that he had preliminary dated to the late Roman, early Byzantine period. So like 2nd-3rd century CE to 7th century CE. And he had already gone out and scouted the area. They had done a field walk, and it was 2009. And that year they wanted to go back and really analyze the kind of stuff that they had found at that site in Israel. So I signed up for that project, and I went with Jürgen that summer to Israel. And indeed, we had found the site with architectural materials, and we were going to start a real excavation project at that site. So in 2010 was the first real excavation campaign. And I believe that's when me and Rick met. Were you there in 2010? Yeah. And so we started excavating that site, and we had a couple of houses, but then we also found the remains of a big structural, architectural, large compound building, which we pretty much very, very quickly identified as an ancient synagogue. And so for the years after that, we went back to that site every single year. And we started focusing more and more on the excavation of just the synagogue. And we kind of stopped working on the houses, but we switched to the synagogue. And that is the point when then I also became interested in what are synagogues, how can you archaeologically recognize them in the field, what was their function, when did people start building synagogues, all of those questions. And I eventually did my thesis under Jürgen in Leiden on first century synagogues. And so that was just kind of by coincidence, because that's the building that we had at that site that instigated me to look deeper and really start focusing on synagogues specifically. And that one thing led to another, and that led to a dissertation project on synagogues. So it really was the beginning of a unexpected journey into ancient synagogues. What about you, Rick?
Yeah, I think we have indeed a very similar ways. There might be at the final end in ways that how I maybe really got interested into synagogues might have also some other things to do. But indeed, while Tina was there in 2009, I was actually already there in the field in 2008 when we did the soundings there, and we exposed a really, really small fraction of what ultimately became a part of the wall of the Horvatskur synagogue. At that time, we only had one side of the wall, so we couldn't really detect much. In 2009, I was actually at that time working in commercial archaeology in the Netherlands, so I also couldn't join. I met the director of the excavations, like Jürgen Zangenberg. I also have studied in Leiden University, where Jürgen was or is still a professor. And I was actually busy with my bachelor thesis on the archaeology of Roman Galilee at the time when Jürgen Zangenberg came to Leiden as a professor. And while I've never had a course with him, I introduced myself, and we had nice some meetings, and then he said that he had this starting up project, and so this is how I got involved in Horvatskur. And indeed in 2010 both Tine and I were there, and since then we have been more or less active active there. Like, there have been some gap years from my side, or at least from finishing dissertation, and nowadays I've been, let's say, moving a bit, maybe away, I guess, in terms of my research. And in 2010, the funny thing with the identification process of the synagogue, I still remember in ways that how it were the archaeologists from the Hebrew University, Uzi Liebner and the architect Benjamin Arubas, came to visit the site and came on top of the site in order to, Jürgen Zangenberg had this hypothesis that it seems to fit indeed. And I still remember some words about it, that it indeed, where I think it was, well, either Uzi Liebner or Benjamin Arubas, I'm not entirely sure who said, but that it indeed feels like a synagogue, it smells like a synagogue, it's supposed probably a synagogue, based on the fact that it had its monumentality, the seats and everything, kind of in terms of what would be the iconic synagogue architecture.
I was going to say, I guess that's a good point at which to talk about. So this particular one at Horvatskur you're both talking about is not necessarily representative of synagogues for 2,000 years. So if we focus specifically on perhaps late antiquity at this point, what makes a synagogue? So how do we identify a structure?
Right, because it's actually quite tricky. So in contrast to, for example, churches, which will often have a lot of dedicatory inscriptions and a lot of crosses and a lot of iconography, ancient synagogues don't really have all those different elements. So there have been monumental structures that have been excavated in the past where people have had doubts, is this a synagogue or not? Because it is quite tricky to make a distinction between just a monumental building that was used as a communal space for anything or a synagogue. What makes a synagogue? If there may be religious activities going on inside, well, how do you give evidence for activities happening that are not tangible inside, right? So you only have the archaeology, the architecture to go off on. But in general, ancient synagogues are have several things in common. So first of all, they are always, I'm not going to make general statements. They usually are large buildings that are made out of nicely dressed stones. So in contrast to the houses that are made out of, you know, pebbles and natural stones and uncut stones that are stacked on top of each other, synagogues, there was a lot of care that went into them. The stones were nicely cut into squares. They were nicely placed on top of each other. So there's a lot more effort into the monumentality. They're sometimes topped with a roof that has roof tiles, which almost never happens for common houses. So it's clear that people put a lot of efforts and a lot of money into constructing these giant buildings. Second of all, they often have benches placed all around the four inside walls of the building. So these stone benches that were created and placed against the walls on the inside, so that people would be sitting in a kind of a circle, looking towards each other, like looking to, so in contrast to churches where seats are placed in rows, one behind each other, and you're all looking to the front. Synagogues have a circle kind of structure where everyone is looking to the middle, the center of the building. And then there's almost always a one or two central plateaus built against the against one of the walls, often the wall that is facing Jerusalem. So the northern wall in southern sides and the southern wall in northern sides. So that when you're looking at that, at those platforms, you're actually looking towards, facing towards Jerusalem. And so those platforms, one or two, was the place where we think the Torah scrolls were housed, in a sort of Torah shrine, sort of a niche on top, and where the rabbi or the priest or whomever was leading this congregation would stand on top of and read out loud from those Torah scrolls, or preach or lead prayer, or that kind of things. So those are the most typical things that every synagogue kind of has in common, no matter the dimension, or if it's a long structure or a short structure, or sometimes the floor will just be beaten earth. Sometimes the floor will have pavement. Sometimes the floor will have mosaics. So there's a lot of difference in other parts of the synagogues, but those are the elements that they all have in common. And so when indeed Arubas came to the site and he saw the monumental blocks and this giant entry into the building, this giant double door with a giant threshold block, and then saw the benches placed against the walls, he was like, yeah, you have a synagogue here. Mm. Even though we didn't have any Jewish iconography, no menorahs, no inscriptions, nor anything. That was what he was basing his assessment on. Right?
Yeah, I think that you gave him quite a very clear description. I don't have that much to add to that. Like later on, we found indeed still at the site a mosaic which has a menorah,
which only confirmed our
but that was but much later, and also but indeed, so the I think what you give quite a clear description in the way that from how
but it can be tricky, right, Rick, because there was a similar structure that was found at the ancient site of Magdala, which is actually not that far away from Horvat Gur, which is known as the birthplace as Mary Magdalene, right? Like Magdala, Migdal. And there was a structure there that was discovered a long time ago. Exactly the same thing, a big monumental building built out of monumental blocks, had benches on the inside of the walls. And it was ascribed as being possibly a synagogue, until Rick wrote a very informative article in which he made the remark that actually it probably was not a synagogue. It was an emphaeum or a fountain house based on parallels from other sites in the Mediterranean. Right. Rick, I'm going to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, like what we're talking about is this, what has been was considered earlier, like something called like a mini synagogue, so we're not talking about what is currently known first century synagogue, but one that was excavated in the 1970s by the Franciscan excavators there, and they like put up the hypothesis as mini synagogue. Me and my colleague Julien Richard were not actually the first one to connect it to a late Hellenistic fountain house. It was actually already Ehud Netzer in a Hebrew article in the 80s who suggested this kind of identification. But but maybe we provided a bit stronger support to that full identification, also because scholars still kept suggesting the idea that it was a synagogue even after. And it might have to do with the language in which the article was written, but we connect we kind of we showed that the this building with steps downwards and with water around it is very much and has a parallel in a building in the site of Sagavassos in southwest Turkey. And it was by coincidence in a way that we came to this because Giulio Richard was an expert on fountain houses in the Eastern Mediterranean, and he was my colleague as a postdoctoral researcher at the time in Leuven. And I showed him this plan in Magdala, and he said, like, this is exactly the one that we have in Sagavassos. A bit smaller, a bit less refined, perhaps, but it's an exact parallel. And he was quite happy because the one in Sagavassos was kind of unique at that time, like for its period.
Yeah, so the Magdala one is kind of interesting in some ways from my mind because, as far as I can recall, the structure that was initially identified in the 1970s would have been one of the earliest ones known at the time because there's a kind of like a ongoing, less so ongoing, but a scholarly discussion around the kind of earliest known synagogues. So often many examples that we see that have kind of been identified have kind of from the first centuries. But in my mind, we seem to have a bit of a disconnect often. So the way you've both talked about identifying these later ones is kind of from a list of architectural features. And I just wonder whether a trend I've noticed in the earlier structures, whether that bears out in the later ones. And what I seem to be under the impression of is that more or less none of these early structures are recorded in any known text. So all the identifications are made based on archaeological and architectural kind of, well, this is what they would have been called, rather than any inscriptions that are kind of attached to them or any reference in any contemporary text to this particular structure. Is that something that is borne out later? So you seem to be saying, like Horvat Kor, there's not necessarily inscriptions associated with it, or is this just kind of some of the earlier cases? Does that make sense?
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at, but if you want to talk about the origin of the synagogue, that's of course one of the questions that we as archaeologists or historians ask ourselves. What was the earliest synagogues? When did this phenomenon start, right? And so it's very hard to pinpoint when the history of the synagogue begins. According to some scholars, they place the origin of this ancient synagogue in the diaspora communities. So during the Babylonian exile, for example, centuries before Common Era, people were cut off from the Jerusalem temple, right? They were in Babylonia. They didn't no longer had access to go to the temple, but they were still Jewish. They were displaced and they wanted to stay connected to their community, both back home and their community that was altogether abroad. And so people think that that might have been the place and the time when ancient synagogues came to be as a sort of gathering space where people got together and talk about their religion and also have social communities, but a place where they could talk and read Torah and talk about God and all of those kind of things. And then We don't actually have any synagogues from those earlier time periods, so we don't know how these structures might have looked like. That could have just been happening in a house, right, in the back room of a house, just like the earliest churches are probably house churches where people just came together in a large space. The same could have been happening for synagogues, where people just came together in someone's house and there wasn't a defined, set-apart structure just for this particular function. From this time period, 1st, 2nd century BCE, we do have the first inscriptions, also from abroad, mostly from Egypt, mentioning the word synagoge or prosoke in Greek, which has been translated as synagogue. But we are not sure if this word refers to an actual architectural structure or if it just refers to a community of people. And the word just means assembly. So any assembly, club, association would also have been called synagogue. It's a group of people who come together for a certain purpose. So we're not quite sure if the word synagogue in those very early inscriptions that we have, or these texts when people talk about the synagogue of the Jews, if that was an actual building or if that was just the club of the Jews coming together. And so the earliest structural buildings that we have are Second Temple period, our 1st century CE, I believe. I don't know what the earliest is, but we have a couple of them from the 1st century CE. And those are not necessarily those monumental large buildings with beautiful mosaic floors, et cetera, that we have from later periods. Those were much more humble kind of buildings. Although not all of them, because the one in Magdala that was found a couple of years ago that has caused such an uproar was already decorated with frescoes, painted walls, and had steps and had mosaics and all of that. But most of them were smaller or more humble, were repurposed rooms in forts or in palaces used for that specific function. And then later over time, they started getting their more specific, unique features that would come back. And every single synagogue. So it grew over centuries of time from something that was maybe just a place where people got together, maybe under the gate, the entrance gate of a city, or maybe at someone's house, into this very specific building that was placed in the most important part on top of the hill of a Jewish site used for that specific function. But we don't have many, many inscriptions that would go and relate like this is a synagogue and this is not a synagogue. So it's hard to kind of connect the text and the inscriptions with the actual buildings that we find archaeologically.
Yeah, you again very nicely laid out the histories, and it's good because that's not really my my strength, I would say, related to how these what I've been interested in relation to the development of, like, why did these communities at some point started to build something that looks like a monumental building to house these assemblies, like we have in the case of Gamla in the Golan Heights, or in the case of Magdala. And those are both, like, I think Magdala is from the 1st century BCE, and like the Gamla's like 1st century CE, early 1st century CE. But there are some other examples as well, like what instigated this particular thing? Because as Tina kind of indicated, we have like assemblies that likely assembled in houses or in some kind of like are not archaeologically identifiable place easily, like, or like identifiable as synagogue place. And that is like the what I've been pondering with those synagogues that come from the 1st century BCE and CE is like how do they connect, but also how do they differ from, for instance, the late antique ones, and for instance, because there are quite much differences. One thing is that their centrality is not so clear. Like the ones in Magdala, it seems to be that it was on the outskirts of the actual town, located in a local community. And the research that Chad Spiegel has kind of indicated is that those synagogue buildings, even the largest one like the one in Gamla, could handle, at least at one time, only a very little percentage of the population of that town, like could have been seated in this place. So if we think of the centrality of the synagogue in terms of people's lives in those houses, like or in those villages or towns, and the idea, at least in late antiquity, that most would have had access to it, I have been arguing, at least in an article, is that in these, for the late Second Temple period, there's not clearly that indication, and that those, even if they are monumental in design, were relatively inaccessible for large parts of the communities of those towns and villages. The most striking fact is always the fact that the synagogue in Gamla, which is, if you access the site now, it's very monumental in design, it had storage facilities right in front of it, in the main facade. You at first had to pass by the storage facilities in order to access the entrance, the main hall. Why would you do it? It kind of hides the entrance into a building. So this comes to the discussion on public and private, where you can clearly see that those late antique synagogues, like the one in Hof at Chur, has this public function with its immediate access into the entrance, into the main hall, double doors, big facade. You do not clearly see that in the case of the earlier ones, the first century ones. And I have argued perhaps to see them, for instance, as this more semi-public or semi-private space. And in that sense, they actually very much connect to the house synagogues, which were much more semi-public or semi-private, depending on how you look at it, than a normal house is as such. That is something I wanted to touch.
It's a very interesting discussion to think about who was making use of these spaces, right? Because for a long time, people thought, well, it's a Jewish community. There's a large synagogue in there. Every single person in that community goes to synagogue, right? It's kind of what we're expecting of, you know, having a church in Christian societies right now. Like everyone goes to church on Saturday or on Sunday. But then Chad Spiegel, for example, indeed came around and kind of calculated this is how many people would fit in this building at any given time. And this is how many people we kind of estimate would live in this town. And it's only a very small percentage of people who would go to these synagogues. Even if you take away the women and say, okay, it's just men who went to, or just adult men, even then you don't get to the percentage of like it's all men of that village that would go to synagogue. So maybe it was only a very small percentage, maybe the most religious people or just the rabbis or the most educated would go there and have religious and political discussions. And it was not for your average, I want to say average Joe, but sorry, Joe. Right? So it's kind of like who was using these spaces?
I think that's a really important thing in terms of access. So if we're saying, and the figures to hand, it's something like 10 to 15% of the population in Gamla can fit in at any one time in that structure. Magdala, it could be as little as 1% because the structure is quite small and they think the city is quite big. So can we then ask questions about who the people are who are using these spaces for, let's say, non-work purposes? So this isn't necessarily an economic activity. What kinds of things are they doing and who are the people who can do that? And I know Tina's mentioned a few like supposed activities, but do we also have any evidence architecturally for anything that's being done at any period kind of in antiquity?
Well, what strikes me from this is again about the late Second Temple period synagogues. What strikes me most architecturally, particularly the Gamla synagogue is the fact that it has this channels going through the building where it appears that cisterns located outside of the city during overflow would channel into going through the actual synagogue building and then enter into a pool, which later was converted into a stepped pool that supposedly was used for ritual purification purposes, that was outside of the synagogue. That means that the people who had access to the synagogue, who could have, had also access and could block at any time the water flow into into the pool, like whether it was used for ritual purification, but also perhaps for other purposes as well. Which means that those who had access were of some significance for that community, some power, and as such, it's not only that, but also simply the architectural features do resemble in some ways the late Hellenistic Bulateria, as I've argued, and as such, like these were city or town councils in some ways, where important matters were being discussed by a selected few, likely. What I'm interested in is what happened actually outside of it. What happened, for instance, during those meetings or during those assemblies? What happened actually on the outside? Because there was still sound, there was still people knew that people were gathering. And you might have heard things because buildings are not like soundproof completely. And as such, what would have been overheard by those people who didn't have the access into it? And what did they, and what kind of gossips were there on the other side about all these kind of things? And what led that? That is actually the thing that I'm perhaps probably most intrigued about, even though of course it's more speculative in some ways, that is something I do enjoy thinking about. But I, in terms of what other uses there are, still.
Well, here I think we should bring up the Theodosius inscription, right? That was found. So I believe it was in the 1970s where they found, no. Much earlier,
1914
around. Yeah, much earlier, 1910. There was this inscription that was found in Jerusalem, written in ancient Greek, and it has been dated to second century CE. So, one of the first kind of the early synagogue phase. And on the inscription, I'm just going to read it out loud. It's you can translate it as Theodotus, son of Vedinus, priest and head of the synagogue, so it's called archisynagogos in Greek, son of a head of a synagogue and grandson of a head of a synagogue. Mm. So there's three generations here of people who were all head of a synagogue in the first century CE. Built the synagogue for A, the reading of the law and for the teaching of the and B, for the teaching of the commandments, and C, as well as a guest room, the chambers, and the water fittings as an inn for those in need from abroad. The synagogue, which his fathers founded with the elders and Simonides. So people have been really talking about this inscription because it's the only one that kind of tells us what was going on inside of those early synagogues. So there was clearly reading of the law going on. So reading the Torah, the teaching of the commandments, which has often been understood as people were talking about like rabbinic law kind of formation here, maybe praying, those kind of more religious aspects around reading the Torah. And then the space was also used apparently as a guest room for people who were traveling and wanted to stay in the village. And that's why there were water fittings and water sources for people that they could use. So it seems that it was a multifunctional space, at least in that time period, at least in Jerusalem, for that one synagogue. So in how far we can make a general comment that happened in all synagogues, both in Israel and in diaspora, et cetera, is difficult to figure out. But that's what that specific inscription says about early synagogues.
So returning to the Gamla one, in some ways, there's also evidence that particularly during the revolt, when the town experienced an influx of refugees, this is kind of the late 60s CE, when Rome's invading the region and there's a lot of turmoil, that the Gamla structure is used as emergency accommodation, let's say. So there's kind of traces of fire pits on the upper kind of channel, I think in the same place where the water channel runs through. So at this time, we kind of see it being given over to, it's not quite the Xenia idea from Theodotus' inscription, but that kind of the functionality is malleable in many ways, so it's able to become a space that serves other purposes. And then there's also the all these inscriptions that are kind of known from the antiquities market. So there's a bit of questionable use of them, because, and a lot of them have subsequently been lost as well, which is also troubling. But many of these first, second century inscriptions are frequently documenting that slaves are manumitted in these places. So there's that, all these kind of ties going on. Like, it's not just what we might think of religious practices.
Right, but we also have a modern look at religion, right? We also see religion and state as separate entities, where we have a special building for our religious activities and we have a special building for our jurisdiction and our legal aspects, and then we have a separate one for our socializing, and we have our bars and our pubs, and those are all separate spaces. While I don't think that's how an ancient Jew saw the world, right? It was all much more intermingled. Religious law was legal secular law as well, and it was a way of socializing and looking at the world and interacting with your community. So it would make much more sense that all of that was happening in the same building. You don't need specific different buildings for that.
Yeah, like, I mean, it connects the same way that, like, also in the Roman world itself, like, religion and political, the political is in general the same thing. And as such, like, that, for instance, a synagogue would function as a gathering place for city council meetings or for other kind of gatherings. Like, it's for them it was the same thing. And indeed what Tina already indicated, like, our multitude of functions that it might have served at any point of time, but, like, archaeologically that is becomes really, at least based on finds or architecture, it's almost impossible to necessarily detect.
The downside of excavating a synagogue is that synagogue was a public space, and so it was kept, it was well kept, it was cleaned out. And even if it was destroyed at some point, in many cases, it would have been first emptied before abandoned. Or if it was half destroyed because of an earthquake or whatever, people would go back and get their precious items out of it. So it's not like a house where you find household items everywhere, and there are pots and pans everywhere and daily tools everywhere. When we excavated Horvat Kur, we didn't find anything on the floor surface. It was swept clean. And so it's very, if you don't have any material objects coming from these spaces, it's very hard to try to figure out what was going on. Because probably even if you had communal meals in these buildings, people could come and bring their own bowls and stuff inside, and then after the meal, take them back out. And so we don't have anything left that would give us any clues of, like, this is what's happening here, which is the tricky part.
This brings me to the fact about, like, there have been, of course, some, one thing that we know and that has been quite well documented that have been found in particularly the late antique synagogues. So we're talking, like, if we move from Gamla 500 years later, more or less, there is hundreds and hundreds of coins And I know at least that Dina has studied them quite much in depth, to my knowledge. And as such, like, I think that Dina should be like, what are these coins like? What do they signify? Why are they there found in or next to synagogue signs?
Right, let's coincide. Yes. Well, so that was actually the topic of my dissertation, which I just finished up a couple of months ago. Because yes, people have, in general, not find much materials inside these synagogues, not much pots and pans. But we found coins, and a lot of coins. And so I actually wrote in my dissertation, I made a catalog of all the coin, I call them hoards or deposits. So not like single coins, but groups of coins that have been found in synagogues. And I made a list of 26 synagogue buildings that we have in which coin groups deposits were found. But there's a difference between these kind of groups. And that's also, I think, between the function of these kind of groups. Some groups of coins were found above floor, so hidden in a pot that was stored somewhere in the synagogue, or put together in what we think was a purse, some material that has now deteriorated over time, that was placed inside that platform that I was talking about with the Torah shrine, for example. And other synagogues, we have found hundreds and sometimes even thousands of coins under the floor, hidden under the floor, immediately below it, clearly meant to stay there. So it wasn't like, oh, we dropped a couple of coins while we were constructing this floor and we kind of like lost them and that's it. No, there were like hundreds and thousands of coins under these. That was no longer a coincidence. Plus, if someone was making those floors and you would see all those coins, you kind of pick them up, you would assume. You won't just leave them there. So the fact that they were left there and then plastered into the floor must have had a specific function. And that was kind of the reason for my dissertation, where we don't have any written sources talking about this phenomena of putting coins under floors in ancient synagogues. So why were people doing that? What was the goal? What was the function of these coins? And so I have linked them to some sort of magical, practical atmosphere where people would, it's kind of like throwing in coins into a fountain, where you throw in a coin and then you wish for something, or you bless the building. It kind of brings good luck. But even more than that, I also connected it to tithing, which is a Jewish construct where you're supposed to take X amount, 10% of your income, and you're supposed to bring it to the temple in Jerusalem, and then that would pay for food for the priests and all of that kind of stuff. After the temple got destroyed in 70 CE, people no longer had the place to bring those coins to. But it was still something that you were obliged to do. It's still part of your tradition, still in the Hebrew Bible, that you should keep tithings separate from your day-to-day economic money. So I think people were still keeping those tithing monies out of circulation. And then over time, it became less than 10%. It kind of became a symbolic. You keep like a coin a year, which a lot of Jews still do. Up until this time, they still will have like a drawer somewhere in their house where they keep like their symbolic tithing money separate. That's money designated for God. And so I kind of made the argument that if you are constructing a synagogue into your community, especially in late antiquity, where a synagogue becomes more and more a religious building and kind of like lost most of its communal functions, but became more of an imitation of the temple. At that point, people realized the temple would not be rebuilt anytime soon. And so many of the rituals and traditions that at one point was happening at the temple was now being done in synagogues, which in the first couple of centuries was kind of not done. That was like some things you only could do in the temple. But after a while, the people realized, well, the temple's coming back. Why don't we just do it in synagogues? And so it's a process called imitatio templi, where you kind of like imitate the temple. And so the synagogue became like a kind of mini temple in your community. So I thought it's kind of logical then that if you're constructing a synagogue building and it's a place for God, and you already have money that is set apart for God, and you were supposed to bring it to the temple, and the synagogue is kind of like a temple, why not throw your coins into that construction? So you get rid of it, you give back to God what belongs to God, plus you're kind of like blessing the building, blessing it maybe against earthquakes, and blessing the visitors who come into the building against disease and the plague that was going around, and And so that was kind of the conclusion of my bigger dissertation. Of course, there's no like physical evidence for any of this. It's kind of my kind of reasoning for why those coins were there. But it kind of made it feel logical to me that everyone can contribute at least a little bit to the synagogue. Even though if you're not rich, you can't donate a mosaic floor, you can't pay for the bigger things, but at least like a little bit of you is in that building as well by throwing in a couple of coins, was my conclusion. So
does that hold actually for the like also the ones below the floor levels?
Those are the coins below the floor levels. Yeah.
Okay.
Those are the ones that I'm talking about. The other ones that were stored above floor level, I have also divided them up in different categories, but I believe some of them might be charity hoards where people had to give to charity. And then when something happened to the building, it got destroyed because of an earthquake, that pot with charity money was still inside there and just people didn't go back to get it. So it was there. There were also a couple of hoards that were very expensive that only had gold coins in it. And a gold coin is like months and months of salary for one person. And to find hundreds or even thousands of coins is like basically a treasure. So I kind of said maybe these are the savings hoards from the synagogue or from the community at large that were kept there for future renovations of the building, or if they have to pay taxes or those kind of things where people kept their savings, or the community or the synagogue leader kept the savings there in a pot or in a hollowed out stone in one case. When the building got destroyed, the plague came around, there were soldiers, whatever, it was just left behind and it was never retrieved again. So those are kind of like different categories for coin deposits in synagogues.
But not every synagogue has a
no.
coin deposit.
No.
Is there right. any, have you found an explanation for its
no.
history? Okay.
So most of those, the ones specifically under the floor, were all in Galilee and the Golan. So almost none of them were in the south, in the Negev. So it seems to be a regional thing. And for why, especially there? So I kind of link it to because the Galilee was also the center of rabbinics around Tiberias. And maybe because of that rabbinic influence, people did it, or I don't know, maybe rabbis went around and said it was a good idea, or like it happened in one synagogue and someone heard it from their neighbors and thought, that's a good idea, let's do it here too. Maybe people were a little bit more religious there and they did have those tidings, where maybe they didn't in the south. It's clearly not happening in every synagogue. So why in certain ones and not in other ones? I don't know.
I mean, it makes sense that there is some kind of a distribution and not everybody at the same time would have developed this kind of like ritual or like this aspect, and the fact that it's in Galilee, which in late antiquity where like rabbinic Judaism came up, like, and not all at once necessarily, and each community might have developed in its own way, each town, each village, each region, and that in the south where it might have taken longer for, let's say, the rabbinic movement to gain.
Plus, I also looked at the date of those coins, and it seems to be a phenomenon that only started in like the late 5th century. So most of the synagogues that were built before that time that we have excavated wouldn't have that yet, right? So it's only certain synagogues starting to be built at a certain time that would start to have this phenomenon. And then when Islam came around 7th, 8th century, there were no more new synagogues built, or not that we have found yet. So then we also don't have any floor deposits from those periods, obviously. So it's only for a couple of centuries when a building would be constructed or a floor would be renovated that we would have that phenomenon.
So fascinating. That's the end of part one of my interview with Dr. Tina Rosala and Rick Bonney. I thank them so much for their chat, and we'll be back next week with the end to that. You can look forward to that in your inboxes or subscription services or feeds, however you access the podcast. I'm also organising a giveaway. I've been very fortunate to receive some bonus copies of two books on the synagogue. They're both collected volumes of essays and both are very good. These are The Synagogue in Ancient Palestine, edited by Rick Bonney, Raimo Hakala and Ulla Tervehauter. And the second, edited by Lutz Doring and Andrew Krauss, is The Synagogue in the Hellenistic and Roman Periods. I'll be organising giveaways for both of these books separately over on Twitter. You can follow me at Joseph D for Delta Scales or at Ancient A Lives over on Twitter as well. So if you want to be in the chance of winning those, head on over there and give us a follow and look for details. Thanks very much for listening. Take care.